Welcome to Wisdom of the Elders Radio, featuring the stories, songs, and science of Indigenous elders from Alaska and the Pacific Northwest, and their responses to today's unprecedented environmental and climate issues. I'm Arlie Neskai of the Diné Nation. In the next hour, we'll explore the world of the Inupiaq and learn how climate issues are affecting every aspect of life on Alaska's North Slope. We'll meet an Inupiaq whaling captain and hear the stories of Inupiaq singers. We'll listen to the tale of Sedna, the mother of sea beasts, and hear how the mayor of Barrow, Alaska, adapted from a life of herding reindeer to hunting whales.
My excitement was so like, will I pass my father-in-law's test? Will he allow me to sew on the next spirited skin boat?
This is Wisdom of the Elders Radio. Stay with us.
You not just a feeling, it smooths the grace that reflects our lives, remembers the bond that held us alive. Times a day we lose our sight of how we have to make things right, give back to what has gave for years, create a flow of happy tears, to feed through our own land, we nourish and serve now every man, and although we've turned from us to me, the spirit will always be. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
A light wind blows across the surface of the stone-gray Arctic Ocean. You can almost sense the curvature of the Earth so near the North Pole. Today, standing on America's northernmost point near Barrow, Alaska, it is deceptively calm. The Arctic Ocean is rising. Loss of sea ice, expansion due to rising temperatures, and the melting ice sheets of Antarctica and Greenland are contributing to a sea level rise of 3 millimeters every year. That doesn't seem like a lot, but to the Inupiaq who live on the North Slope, this is no future crisis. It is happening now. Several of Alaska's Inupiaq villages are home to what may become America's first climate refugees, forced to flee their communities because of rising sea levels and higher storm surges that erode the shore, destroying homes, buildings, and ancient burial grounds.
Shishmaref is a major sealing community.
Amy Topcock grew up in Shishmaref, a village on the edge of the Chukchi Sea.
Basically, it's a sand spit, and it's about 3 miles long and 1 mile wide. And there's a very large lagoon in the back. I remember that beach being much bigger. And then when it went out, it was much farther. Nowadays, it's hardly any beach in the front because of the way the waves have come in, have eaten away at the sand.
The Inupiaq, known collectively as Inupiaq, are the original peoples of Alaska's Arctic region. They depend culturally, nutritionally, and sometimes economically on hunting and fishing for their lifeways. Inupiaq elder and art teacher Dick Wayuana remembers.
Up here in the north, young men would follow out to the sea ice for whaling, and that was still in the months of school. And so you would see some of my classmates really getting edgy and wanting to go home because it was that time of the year to go out and subsist. We went out on the ice a lot, mainly for the bearded seal, which was really important, our staple diet.
Memories of Shishmaref soon may be only stories to pass down. For the effect of sea level rise on the village is sometimes seen as the most dramatic in the world. It means this village on the barrier island of Shereshef is jeopardized. Another Inupiaq village, Kivalina, is on an island between the Chukchi Sea and a lagoon at the mouth of the Kivalina River. It's projected that Kivalina will be inundated by 2025. George Edwardson is an Inupiaq geologist from Barrow, Alaska.
The erosion is natural. You can't stop it. But if you're going to move a community, you better make sure that community goes to an elevation of no less than 250 feet, otherwise it will be in the water again. Natural.
The Inupiaq descend from the old Bering Sea culture. They were misnamed as Eskimo by anthropologists and incoming settlers. But when indigenous peoples of Canada and Greenland objected that the name Eskimo was an insult, their traditional name was restored. Inupiaq means the real people. The Inupiaq are whalers. The capture of a whale is accomplished by the whole community, and it benefits each member of an Inupiaq village, whether a resident or someone living far from home. The Inupiaq have lived in harmony with a harsh environment for thousands of years. But the rapidly changing climate is forcing never-before-seen changes in Alaska. Over the past 60 years, the state has warmed twice as rapidly as the rest of the U.S., leaving the Inupiaq to face a disruptive landscape that threatens their well-being, their health, and their traditional lifeways. Yeah. Inupiat elders tell us of the importance of passing along their history, stories, observations, dances, language, and traditions to instill a deeply held sense of identity in their younger generations. Dick Wayuana passes his traditions along through art.
First, you introduce the very basic, and you get the students to work on, like, soapstone, to work with their hands, to see things three-dimensionally. And later, they come to realize that, they can alter those shapes. They can make it more abstract. Stories are the most important. Whenever you can tie in a work of art with a story, then you're more apt to transfer that thought to others. You try to pass that to the younger generation that you, no matter what it is, you work to make it the finest.
Driving through the streets of Bear, Alaska is a unique experience. Front yards are crowded with boats, snow machines, drying hides of bearded seal, caribou, and occasionally the enormous skull of a bowhead whale. Inside in his easy chair at home, Inupiat elder Eugene Brower is friendly and confident, but there is an undercurrent of seriousness in his voice. Change is coming, and how his people hunt, how they govern themselves, and their balance with nature. Ice is thinning. Migratory patterns for animals are adjusting to the longer, warmer seasons. The Inupiat are adapting to these changes, and Brower hopes some of his people's traditions will abide. For today's Elder Wisdom, Brian Bull has more.
Eugene Brower has spent much of his life in Barrow, Alaska, the northernmost tip of the state, and therefore the United States. It's a community where tradition and technology are cobbled together. Among the most cherished traditions here is whaling, which Brower recalls surrounded him, literally as a young boy, spending winters with his grandmother in a sod house.
A sod house is made out of whale ribs that are curved and spaced so far apart, and then they get the driftwood cut into planks and put on the side so high. You get the ground, cut the soil, and pack it around. It'll form into a little dome-shaped house. They'll make a little door, and they get a little piece of wood for an opening. They either use the lining of the stomach or something to make a window. The light can come in during the daylight hours.
Whether it was reading the stars to navigate the craggy landscape or crafting skin boats from the hides of bearded seals, the youth gained knowledge, experience, and humility.
Over 90% of the whale is underwater. You're just looking at the surface. You know, look at that. You visualize how far away from the whale you're going to throw your harpoon if you're not right on top of it. They hit your vital organs of what you're taught to aim at. So depending on the distance you're from the whale, you compensate for the movement of the whale to throw your harpoon so it'll strike the area where you want it to strike.
That people, many more children than adults, were involved in hunting large, powerful whales is something that could make one feel strong, brave, and boastful. But Brower says that's not the Inupiat way.
You have to humble yourself for this great animal because he can damage your boat so easily. And we have seen it when it showed its strength. My father's whaling crew, my father was alive and we're whaling with him in the spring. We launched our boat, our skin boat, there's a whale coming. And then the whale just went over, flipped over, went underneath our boat. Arms came up, grabbed our skin boat, and rocked it back and forth. And I told our crew, don't move. Tail this whale, he's away from us, because with a tail, he can flip us over. The strength of that tail is so strong, we're like a matchstick. And the whale went past us, blew out three or four times, and sounded. That was touch your soul, what you could do if you wanted to do it. when you prepare yourself to go out, like in the spring, this fall whaling, my wife and I will prepare our crew and get the boat ready. But we'll pray. Have a gathering and we'll pray that we'd like to send our crew out. Also like to receive a whale through our boat, feed our community. And if we're lucky, and he hears and he bless us, we'll land a whale. I have been taught never to say, I caught a whale, or I landed a whale. We were taught never to brag about it. You just do it and keep going to feed your family and your community and your extended family members that live away from Barrow. It is an honor to receive a whale.
But over time, Brower has seen climate changes in the northernmost reaches of Alaska.
When I was growing up, this time of the year, it used to be full of snow. The lake would be freezing. People would be getting ready to go up to their fish camps to go fishing. Now we're having to wait into October before we get a freeze. They get slush ice in the ocean. And it's where ice free even in December. So we have changed a lot from a subsistence lifestyle to a cash economy. But a lot of us still subsist off the land and the ocean. We just have to adapt to it. When the window of our opportunity is there to get the animals that we live off from, we have to get them. But also we have regulations that are being forced upon us by the federal government, by people that have no inclination how we live our lives up here, making laws in D.C. Like any other place in this God's green earth, different people live off different groups of animals and fish. Whatever is on their land sustain their livelihood. Here in the high Arctic, that ocean is our garden. It sustains our livelihood. Even though we may have college degrees and all this other stuff and education, our way of life evolves around the seasons, the cycle of life. The fresh game will sustain our livelihood for the year. So we stock up our supply for the winter. And that's what we eat a lot in this household, is what is given to us of what my boys and I get from the ocean and the land.
Beyond the turn of seasons, Brower's tribe has some say in its affairs. After demonstrating to the federal government that there were far more bowhead whales than it could count, the Inupiat were allowed to set their own whaling limits. The tribe also meets with other whaling cultures from across the globe in order to learn subsistence practices that will keep the whale numbers strong while also keeping their traditions alive for future generations. For Wisdom of the Elders, I'm Brian Bull.
Brian Bull is an enrolled member of the Nez Perce tribe and currently chairs Vision Maker Media, dedicated to supporting and promoting authentic Native productions and storytelling. He lives with his wife, three kids, and four cats in the greater Cleveland area of Northeast Ohio. Coming up in Sacred Landscape, Judy Bluehorse Skelton shares some insights into the importance of ice. And in Tribal Rhythms, Nico Nguyen introduces us to the music of the Inupiat.
Rhythm is a part of every piece of music, story, poem, song, and dance. It is the constant within change, like the beginning and ending of each day.
This is Wisdom of the Elders Radio. Stay with us. For the Nupiaq, ice is life. Without the annual buildup of ice on the shore, Inupiat hunters would have no way to reach the abundant food sources in the Arctic Ocean. Today, in Sacred Landscape, Judy Bluehorse Skelton looks at how the changing landscape of the Nupiaq is linked to food security, food safety, and the survival of an ancient culture.
Inupiat villages are located near the icy shore, so the community has the best access to fishing, sealing, whaling, and walrus hunting. But last year, Arctic sea ice reached the lowest record in 1,500 years. This accelerating loss of sea ice has drastic consequences, not only for food security, but for large animals and tiny plants alike. Amy Topcock is an Inupiat scholar and sealskin artist.
Uvungatiga Anohuk. Anohuk is my Eskimo name, and it means little girl. I'm originally from Kotzebue, but my parents are from Shishmaref and Noatak. My English name is Amy Topcock. Well, like I said, I've traveled back to Shishmaref ever since I was little every summer because of my dad. He had a government job, and he was able to get 2 weeks off in June. He felt, as a Native man, it's very important to be able to go back and provide for his mom and for us as a family. Again, I'm one of six children, so that's many mouths to feed. Whatever we can help subsist in the summertime, that we can bring back to Kotzebue and have food for the winter.
Health and traditional foods are inextricably tied, especially in Arctic Alaska. Foods such as game, fish, seafood, berries, algae, greens, and water provide sustenance and good health.
You have to go out there and, you know, cooperate with other family. And now with the high cost of gas and supplies, you have to cooperate even more to be able to go out there and get your seals and your food that you want to put in your freezers for the rest of the year.
There are also cultural connections through storytelling, ceremonies, and the traditional gathering, processing, and sharing of these resources, not just for food, but for traditional clothing.
I have come from a skin sewing family. My mom skin sewed, both my grandmothers skin sewed. They still skin sew a lot there. They make mukluks, they make mittens, they make hats. Now I've seen even beautiful gloves, all out of sealskin. And purses. There's so many things that they've done in keeping that tradition alive, but also it has become a way for them to make their money.
Lately, Inupiaq are observing that their ocean is not as healthy due to environmental and climate issues. Inupiaq seal hunters were recently cautioned about disease impacting several seal species and walruses in the Bering and Chukchi Seas. Pollution of marine mammal ecosystems is a serious concern for the Arctic's Inupiat people and scientists studying its effects on human health. Climate impacts are threatening availability of traditional foods in the Arctic, and this creates a problem of food security.
What is food security? Do you have sufficient amounts? Do you have access to adequate amounts of food when you need it? Next slide.
Mike Brubaker, director for the Center for Climate and Health, is documenting how changes in the environment affect the availability of adequate amounts of food for Alaska Natives.
I know whenever I eat caribou or salmon or waterfowl or wild plants, I feel and I'm confident that I'm getting really healthy food. But because the environment is changing, there are new challenges, there are new threats. And there are also new opportunities, but we want to be aware of these because as stewards of the environment and as people who consume wild foods, we need to be informed. So what are some of the climate impacts on food resources? We're learning location by location, event by event, the types of food challenges that are emerging, and largely we're also learning that there are good strategies that people are applying in order to adapt.
Mike is using a slideshow to demonstrate his ideas to the Native audience at a recent climate conference in Anchorage, Alaska. He points to slides of an ice cellar.
And some of the types of climate-related challenges that are occurring have to do with food storage. Now, this is a picture from Barrow It was taken in January, but that's an underground cellar. It's quite a deep one. But because of warming, you see a lot of icicle formation along the sides of the cellar.
After a successful hunt, people of the north may have thousands of pounds of food to store. All across Alaska, people have cut into the frozen ground called permafrost to make ice cellars, well-like holes in the permafrost designed with narrow openings. Until recently, permafrost would never thaw deeper than a foot from the surface during the summer. But now the ground may thaw as far down as 12 feet.
And when storage systems fail, spoilage can become a concern. And there's also been reports of some food coming from cellars that were no longer safe for consumption because they have spoiled. And we also begin to become concerned when we have changes in the temperature or changes in the moisture level within storage areas, that it may become a mechanism for creating a disease such as botulism. And this is, this food in the bottom of this ice cellar, also in Barrow, has been put in bags because it's so wet. But when you start putting things into bags, we have to be concerned about the creation of botulism.
To understand how accelerating sea ice loss affects overall Arctic ecology, scientists examined the relationships between algae, plankton, whales, and terrestrial animals, such as caribou and Arctic foxes, for a study published recently in the journal Science. The study said, the loss of over 2 million square kilometers of Arctic sea ice since the end of the last century represents a stunning loss of habitat. Sea ice is home for algae and plankton, which together produce 57% of all the food in northern oceans. The report said that mass mortality among Pacific walrus along the coast of the Chukchi Sea has been attributed to loss of sea ice cover over the continental shelf. When formerly abundant traditional food sources become unavailable through migration changes, disease, or extinction, native people must rely on domesticated meat and commercially produced foods, often laden with sugar, flour, and preservatives.
Those of you who are actively involved in the collection, preservation, storage of traditional foods throughout the year know how much work this is. But, you know, one thing we can take stock in is that we live in a landscape that has traditionally and to this day many bountiful sources of wild foods.
We thank the folks at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium for sharing their time with us. Finding modern solutions such as these, while using their ingenuity and their ancient past, are the ways that the Inupiat, long known for demonstrating resilience and collaborative problem-solving, will survive long into the future. With each step, with each heartbeat, Osadadu.
Judy Bluehorse Skelton is Nez Perce and Cherokee, and a faculty member in the Indigenous Nations Studies Program at Portland State University. Judy integrates traditional ecological knowledge with Indigenous land management practices to address food and medicine sovereignty and reclaim our physical, emotional, and spiritual health. Life has rhythm, the heartbeat, the daily round, the yearly freezing and thawing of the shore ice, the arrival of the whales, the honk of the geese over the trackless tundra. We celebrate life's rhythms through our music. The thunder of Inupiat drums fills the heart with a joyful feeling that life and rhythm are one. One cannot live without the other. Today on Tribal Rhythms, Nico Wind explores the world of Inupiat music and how it embodies the rhythms of a subsistence lifestyle.
The long row of drummers strike wide skin-covered hoops. Their voices electrify the stage. Dancers move in strong, synchronized gestures, linking elbows, signifying friendship, community, and endurance.
How the drum came to the Inupiat people was through a great eagle. And that's the beginning of the messenger feast, the Kivikik.
Inupiat singer and drummer Sean Topkop comes from Teller, Alaska, north of Nome. He and his family formed the Pava Inupiaq Dancers of Fairbanks, Alaska, who perform traditional and newly created dances.
The eagle mother, after her son was shot down by a hunter, taught a man how to sing and drum. And then that man was visited by spirit people to show them motion dances. And he was put in charge of teaching these motion dances to his village. And then his village was put in charge of teaching these dances and motions and drumming to their neighboring villages. So that's the messenger part, whereas these messengers were sent off to these different villages. And they were put in charge to come together after a while to a meeting, a messenger feast, Kivikik, to celebrate the death of the eagle mother's son.
Thus, the young hunter who has a successful year and has plenty to share hosts the celebration to renew family ties and give thanks to the Creator for all of his gifts. So the initiator of this messenger feast in both ancient and modern times sends out messengers carrying asking or inviting sticks to invite villages. Modern-day messengers might fly in small planes between the villages. They make requests of each to prepare certain items such as furs, ivory, and food. Participants understand that they are also expected to take part in performances of the traditional songs, dances, and storytelling.
And so I think that's something that's really important to share with other people, is the birth of, you know, the drum beat, the heartbeat, is something that we share. And the sounds of the drums, I think, really brings us all together as indigenous people.
The messenger feast was nearly lost in the early 20th century. A renewed concern of the people in the 1980s for their traditional values encouraged elders to reconstruct the messenger feast from their memories. Performances of the songs, dances, and events of the Kivikik served then and now as a remembering of the core of the Inupiaq culture, to live in harmony with the earth, to value the importance of staying in touch with neighbors in an isolated region. Because the messenger feast allows a lot of flexibility and spontaneity, there isn't any one specific structure of events over a period of 3 or 4 days. Typically held every other year in January or February, the modern messenger feast includes competitive events, performances of the eagle wolf dance, storytelling, visiting, feasting, gift-giving, and social and motion dancing that takes place throughout the celebration. Social dancing includes regular dances, motion dances, and dances unique to a particular village.
You had to feel it, and you had to know, basically, kind of the motions enlightened you. You came up with your own interpretations of that, so it has more meaning for yourself. So I think these are important songs that we need to pass on down to our next generations.
The messenger feast traditionally functions as a reunion, a means of bringing villages together to trade and barter and to celebrate a successful hunting season. It will always adjust to meet the changing needs of the Inupiaq people. Contemporary culture is often reflected in the celebration. There might be a Taekwondo award, a Boy Scout presentation, a talent contest with country western music, a Hawaiian hula dance parody, or even a rap song like this one by Inupiat rapper Allison Ward.
Well, I see so much pride in our community. Everywhere I wave high, they wave high back to me. And I've been given so much hugs, and I feel so much elder love. I've been kissing so many cheeks and saying to the youth, yes, you're doing big things. And everybody, I'm so proud from our native community.
For Allison, rap is a means to direct her message to young audiences to strengthen their cultural identity and traditional cultural values.
I do teach a workshop about, it's called Try Rap. And through the course of the workshop, we have a theme usually, and it's usually around healthy communities. So what does your most healthiest community look like in like 20 years or whatever? Like, let's say we magically teleported to our most amazing healthy community that we could ever possibly imagine, and we're here now. What does our day in that community look like? What's going on?
Rhythm is a part of every piece of music, story, poem, song, and dance. It is the constant within change, like the beginning and ending of each day. Scientifically and spiritually, rhythm is the heartbeat of the universe. And it is by these cycles that the practices have been carried down through the generations for thousands of years. For Wisdom of the Elders, I'm Nika Wind.
Tribal Rhythms is written and hosted by Assiniboine and Ojibwe singer and songwriter Nika Wind, who is also the music director at Wisdom of the Elders. For more information about our guests or to help support our program through Friends of Wisdom of the Elders, check out our website at wisdomoftheelders.org. Coming up, Barrow, Alaska's Mayor Charlotte Brower tells of adapting from life herding reindeer to whale hunting. And in STEAM, Roger Fernandez shows how the ancient story of Sedna, the mother of sea beasts, sheds light on the contemporary problem of pollution in the Arctic Ocean.
Once she was a human girl, but now she is a powerful spirit who rules at the bottom of the ocean.
I'm Arlie Neskai, and this is Wisdom of the Elders Radio.
Hello, friends and relatives. I'm Rose Hybear, executive producer of Wisdom of the Elders Radio. I'm proud that my Dekaton Dene and Inupiat family and ancestors have lived along the Yukon River and in the Arctic for nearly 15,000 years. We're producing this fourth series of Wisdom Radio programs to raise awareness of the rich and ever-changing biological diversity in the environments of today's Native American and Alaska Native peoples. For thousands of years, our people have adapted to change. We want today's youth especially to learn from the elders and scientists in this radio series. We also want to introduce you to our cultural artists, the song carriers, dancers, artists, and storytellers whose gifts continue to keep our traditions vibrant. We are the descendants of America's first scientists and cultural artists. It is our responsibility and honor to serve as exemplary role models so we can continue to thrive for the next 15,000 years. Our programs are produced in Portland, Oregon, with funding from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Tulalip Tribe's Charitable Fund, the Puyallup Tribe of Indians, and in-kind contribution from Wisdom's talented radio production team. Thanks, team, and thanks to you, our listeners, for your interest in and respect for American Indian and Alaska Native culture.
Hey, Jaya Kana.
The traditional ways of Inupiat ancestors are not just memories, but live on in their relationships with fish, birds, mammals, plants, and with the earth itself. All of this knowledge is woven into the traditional stories they tell. In today's STEAM, Roger Fernandez relates the ancient story of Sedna, the mother of sea beasts, and shows how the story may reflect present-day environmental conditions in the Arctic.
Countless millennia, native people of the Americas have had a deep connection with nature and its cycles. They have shaped their culture around the environment and the seasonal markers like plant growth, animal migration and behaviors, and the changes in weather and climate. The story of Sedna is told in several variations by different Inuit and Inupiat groups of Alaska and Canada. A mythic legend like this one helps us understand how people from that culture see the world and explains, from their cultural viewpoint, how the world works. Sedna explains how times of struggle occur and how the order of the world is set right again. Listen to this story, not only as a depiction of a view of the world, but also as a powerful metaphor for the environmental problems of our modern world. Sedna is known as the mother of sea creatures. Once she was a human girl, but now she is a powerful spirit who rules at the bottom of the ocean. Sedna did not want to get married and rejected all the young men of her village. But then she fell in love with a dog and married him. All the rejected young men who wanted her for a wife said, "This will bring bad luck." So they took her out to sea in a boat and threw her overboard. Desperately, she clung to the side of the boat, but they chopped off her fingers. As the fingers fell into the sea, they turned into seals and whales and other sea creatures. She sank to the bottom of the ocean and became the spirit ruler of all living things in the sea. Because of all the bad things that have happened to her, she is quick to anger. If someone offends her, she takes away all the sea beings, so people cannot fish or hunt. They say all the bad things humans do fall into the water and collect in her hair as grease and dirt. Sedna has no fingers, so she is helpless to clean her hair. So a brave shaman must go under the water to calm and soothe her. He must pass the terrible guardians of her house and enter. He must untangle and clean her hair of the dirt. He must dress her hair in two thick braids. When this is done, she thanks him by releasing all the sea creatures so humans can have food again. The ancient story of Sedna helps us understand the deep connection of the Inuit and Inupiat people to their living environment, and it also gives us an insight into how their cultural wisdom has meaning today. Recent findings show that there is a dramatic rise in the levels of persistent organic pollutants, or POPs, in the blood and tissue of the Inuit and other Arctic people. POPs are a set of very toxic and long-lasting organic chemicals found in things like pesticides, insecticides, and industrial waste. POPs can be taken in by entire ecosystems, including people and animals. Scientific tests also show that these chemicals, carried to the Arctic by wind and water current, are accumulating in the fatty tissue of the seals and walruses that are the game food of the northern native peoples. These toxins are taken into the people to the point where they now have the highest concentration of POPs of any people in the world, to the level that in Greenland, some mother's breast milk can be classified as toxic. As garbage and pollutants are accumulating at dangerous levels in the Arctic waters, we realize we have reached that point again where we need a shaman with spiritual powers to untangle and clean her hair and give it order by braiding it. We can see the metaphors at play, but what should we do to restore the original balance the stories share with us? We must use our knowledge and wisdom. There are no easy answers, but storytelling is not meant to give us easy answers. They are told to challenge us to find answers that are already within us. Sometimes scientific research helps explain phenomenon we might see happening, and sometimes we need to understand that what we see is only part of the story, like an iceberg where only the tip or 10% is seen above the water. Some of the issues are much bigger and deeper than we realize. For Wisdom of the Elders Radio, this is Roger Fernandez.
Roger Fernandez is an enrolled member of the Lower Elwha Band of Tlalim Indians. He's an artist, an educator, and a storyteller who uses all three talents to share knowledge about the local coastal Salish cultures of Western Washington. He also develops and writes curricula and educational scripts, taking advantage of these distinct cultural perspectives.
The art of sharing was my biggest art that our grandfather, grandmother have taught us. You don't pick for yourself. You pick for the whole community. Always remember, you store.
Alaska's tundra is a cold desert, and yet the treeless land is spattered with hundreds of shallow lakes and full of rich wetlands. Here the caribou thrive. And many of the Nupiat people raise a domesticated caribou called reindeer for their livelihood. Today on Turtle Island Storytellers, Inupiat elder and mayor of Barrow, Alaska, Charlotte Brower, tells a contemporary story of how she made the transition from herding reindeer to whale hunting.
My name is Charlotte Skin Brower. I'm originally from Selawik, born in Kotzebue, raised in Selawik. My father was a reindeer herder, and we lived in a reindeer herd camp, and there were a number of families, primarily the herders. And then we were on one side of the river where the other side, the reindeer, were grazed. Never knew English till I was 6 years old. We've lived off the land. It was a very hard life. Around that time, the federal government came in. They said, this is the area we're going to move the people that wanted to have a village of Selawik. We're going to move them into the high ground. And the area that they picked, because it was most used by my grandfather's herders and my father's herders, was the area where all our herders used to live in tents, and they built their log cabins here and there. So they practiced their eminent domain in saying, this is where we're going to build. So that's how City of Selawik was formed. When my father lost his reindeer in 1960, that was the end of reindeer herding for him. But he lost his father in 1958, my grandfather, and his interest, same as the interest in my grandmother, was not really there. And in a sense, he was grieving for his father. And then my grandmother was pretty much part of that. She let go of everything. They said, we're no longer going up to our corral. And then we lost our reindeer herd in 1960.
hey young hey ya, hey young hey ya, hey young hey ya, hey hey hey.
So at the age of 14, I went off to high school. And when I went off to high school, I never looked back to my region where I grew up. And I went off to Oregon. I tried coming back to my village, but my father said, there isn't anything here for you. There's no jobs for you. Socioeconomic was so bad in my community that my father said, it's best you leave. And it was very hard. Very hard because my grandmother was still alive and I had to leave. Then I got married to my husband. Everyone tells me, is that a culture shock? No, because I'm a reindeer herder's daughter. My grandmother taught me how to sew. My grandmother taught me how to tan. My grandmother taught me everything. And so when the whaling start, and my father-in-law had a crew, they were trying to have a skin sewed. And I tell my father-in-law, I said, I know how to sew. First, I told my husband, but see, I'm not from this area. I'm not supposed to know how to sew on a bearded skin for a boat because I'm from inland. But us inlanders have to tan a skin caribou for waterproof mukluks, and we have to sew so tight. And then we had to overlap and then sew the a certain way. And these are for mukluks or a kayak. And so it was natural. I can do this. I know I can do this. So they gave me a skin thread, a needle, and then they said, oh, we always have one of our lead experts do the startup. Fine, do the startup. So I watch, golly, this is all so familiar. But I can't argue with an elder, especially an expert sewer on a bearded sail. So my excitement was so like, will I pass my father-in-law's test? Will he allow me to sew on the next bearded skin boat? And the practice is of all sewers, once you complete a skin, the men puts it over a boat frame after it's all over and it's ready to be dried outside. As a sewer, you go and inspect your seam. And I went out and inspected my seam, my portion. I passed. And from there on, I was accepted into sewing, and no one doubted me. The art of sharing was my biggest art that our grandfather, grandmother have taught us. You pick, you don't pick for yourself, you pick for the whole community. Always remember, you store what you can't eat, you store, and it comes out on special occasions. No different than here. Almost 90% of what we feed our families in our home here has been off from what my husband or our sons have got. That's one of the things that we give to those that cannot hunt for themselves. So the sharing part is very natural for us. And I think that another part of sharing is storytelling. Part of storytelling is how I tell my grandchildren, because I was a storyteller in my time. I love to tell stories.
On today's program, we have explored the frozen world of the Inupiaq. We've seen how changes in sea level are tearing villages from their foundations and how ice and frozen ground are essential to the Inupiaq way of life. We have heard the stories of the people in song, and Mary Charlotte Brower showed us how adaptation and change are integral to her people. And since ancient times, the mother sea beast has warned of coming environmental degradation. From her story, we learn that we must return to the traditional knowledge of our elders if we are to save our planet for future generations. We hope you enjoyed our program today and learned something to enrich your community's sustainability efforts. We hope to see you again for our next program in this, our fourth series of Wisdom of the Elders Radio, featuring the stories, songs, and science of Indigenous elders from Alaska and the Pacific Northwest, and their responses to environmental and climate issues. Next time, we'll leave the coast and journey into the heart of Alaska and meet the people of the Caribou, the Athabascan tribes. Thanks for joining us today on Wisdom of the Elders Radio. I'm Arlie Neskai. Hagoanet, till we meet again.
Wisdom of the Elders Radio shares the rich teachings of our elders with all people for the betterment of our world. In this, our fourth series, we hope to raise awareness of the rich and ever-changing biological diversity in the environments of today's Native American and Alaska Native peoples. Many thanks to our segment producers, Brian Bull, Judy Bluehar-Skelton, Nico Wind, and Roger Fernandez. Script editor and director, Lawrence Johnson. Studio recording and mixing, Clark Salisbury. Location recording, William Ward. Writers, Terry Hansen and Ann Morin. Production assistant, Daniel Dixon. And executive producer, Rose Hybear. Wisdom of the Elders Radio is produced in Portland, Oregon, with funding by the National Endowment for the Arts, the Tulalip Tribe's Charitable Fund, and the Puyallup Tribe of Indians. We have expanded upon today's program at our website at wisdomoftheelders.org. Until the next time, thanks for joining us today on Wisdom of the Elders Radio.
Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.